Addiction to street drugs, prescription drugs, alcohol, or anything else pulls into its arms not only the addict, but family, friends, and even colleagues. The family member can himself become a sort of addict, addicted to the hope, the fear, the despair, and the patterns of denial, recovery, and destruction that can be part of an addict's life. Denise Crockta, author of Sweat, A Practical Plan for Keeping Your Heart Intact While Loving an Addict, herself the mother of an addict, found that the world offered plenty of opinions and bits and pieces of information about recovery, but that the search for answers was almost as stressful as the addict in her life. On Addicted to Addicts, Survival 101, hear stories of failure and slow triumph, of possibilities, relief, and hope. Sometimes knowledge is scary, but always knowledge is power. Here's your host, Denise Crockta.
So this past week, I spent a lot of time with families who have addiction in their lives. Many people have had addiction in their lives for a very long time, and since they can remember, it's pretty much the same. Things have not changed. Hopefully, they're starting to change themselves, knowing that they can really not control somebody else's behavior. Another thing, I've been getting emails and some calls, and it just never ceases to amaze me how critical and judgmental people can be who haven't had addiction in their lives. And you know what? Maybe they have, and they just don't want to say that they have. But there are some pretty, I guess you would call them pretty rude people in this, in the mindset of, you know, addicts, we should just do away with them. I was reading an article that a senator from Missouri wrote an article, and he had his hands in shooting down the prescription drug list to be able to track people that have been getting their drugs from different pharmacies and things, and in his state of Missouri. And at the end of his article, he said something like, you know, if they overdose or kill themselves, you know, I can't remember exactly what he said, but it was, you know, that it was a good thing, you know, good riddance. And I just can't believe how insensitive people can be. But as long as I've been doing what I've been doing, I can't tell you how many times people just keep telling me I must be a bad mom, a bad this, a bad that. And you know what? It's their problem. It's not mine. I am just so grateful that my son has found recovery and he's been clean for so long. But there are just so many people suffering from this. So that's my rant today. So often we listen to people talking about 12 steps. I noticed I still keep seeing all over the TV all these little innuendo about people going to meetings and doing 12 steps on TV and going to the program and in recovery. So it's getting to be pretty mainstream. So, but the prevalent thing is the 12-step programs. So today I have a gentleman on as a guest. We're going to talk about his theory on recovery and his plan that he has that is not related to 12-step, because he wants to offer something to people that is not 12-step, because there are a lot of people that just don't cozy up to the 12-step program. Although there are millions that do, there are millions that don't. So my guest today is Kenneth Anderson, and he is the founder and CEO of the HAMS, Harm Reduction Network, a free-of-charge, lay-led support and information group for anyone who wants to change their drinking for the better. So we're going to talk to him about his theory on harm reduction, because harm reduction is, it's a very general term, not always used just for drinking and for drugs. And we're going to talk about that today, just to give everybody the idea, the definition, and how it's used. So let's hear a little bit, speaking of harm reduction, we'll hear a little bit from our sponsor, Practical Recovery. Dr. Horvath also is into something alternative to the 12-step program.
Practical Recovery offers self-empowering, non-12-step addiction treatment. We help clients find motivations that are deeper and stronger than addiction. Our doctoral-level staff will help you identify and resolve underlying problems. We offer a variety of rehab and outpatient programs. Call 800-977-6110. That's 800-977-6110. Or visit practicalrecovery.com. It's not too late to enjoy your life.
So before we get to the interview, there's something, I have another little rant today that I want to talk to everybody about. I went through this drama and chaos of my son's heroin addiction and came through this transformation of learning exactly how to live through this kind of thing and keep my own identity and life and trying not to focus or as my show says, being addicted to my addict. And I have lots of insight from what I learned that I like to share with people. I wrote my book, Sweat, A Practical Plan for Keeping Your Heart Intact While Loving an Addict. I wrote this specifically to make life easier for those of you navigating through this chaos and drama of someone's addiction. So I hope that one day you'll all read this because it really is, it's very simple, very practical, and I made it for people who cannot focus because I certainly could not focus when I was going through this. So I would like to encourage you to go to my website, addictsfamilylifeline.com, or just click on the host website button here on the radio show page and check out the book. I encourage everyone to read it, and when you read it, if you would, click on the button on the website or on the radio show page, the email button, and send me an email. Let me know what you think about it. I would really appreciate that. So let's get back to Kenneth Anderson and our interview today on harm reduction.
Hi, welcome to the show. May I call you Ken or Kenneth?
Ken is fine.
Ken is, okay, great. So I'd like to introduce my audience to my guests by having the guests tell a little bit about their growing up, where they grew up, where geographically they grew up, what kind of family, you know, single kid, you know, do you have brothers and sisters, what it was like in middle school, high school, that kind of stuff. You know, just give a general background if you could, please.
Sure. I was born in Wisconsin. My parents were extreme fundamentalist Christian teetotalers who never touched alcohol. When I was 13, I read Darwin and I became an atheist for a while, and then I read Spinoza and became a pantheist. And I still consider myself a pantheist. Mm-hmm. So I don't believe in a divine intervention, but I do believe there's purpose in the universe. I went to school in Eau Claire, Wisconsin for a little while, to college, spent 6 years in Japan, went back and finished my master's in linguistics at the University of Minnesota, and most recently I've been studying psychology and substance abuse counseling at the graduate level at the New School University in New York City.
Okay. Now that was a quick synopsis. I'm going to give you get a little more in-depth here. Can you tell us when you were, let's say, in grade school, you did tell me about your parents. Did you have brothers and sisters?
Yeah, I have two brothers and one sister.
And since you told us a little bit about your progression in your thought processes, with being in that kind of family, the fundamentalist, how did your brothers and sisters take to this as a future?
Well, I really didn't talk about it very much in my family. I just had to I was from a farm, so what I wound up doing was working on the farm and buying a lot of books by mail order and doing a lot of self-study until I was 20 and finally entered college then.
Mm-hmm. So did your siblings go along with your family concept?
Yes, pretty much so. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Well, I think they rebelled a lot. I mean, both of my brothers were quite big drinkers, but I don't think they rebelled on an intellectual level so much as on a level of action.
Right. So living on the farm growing up, and I guess you're going to school like regular kids do. What was the alcohol and drug atmosphere in your middle school and high school when you were growing up?
I think I was intoxicated one time. I was almost never exposed to alcohol until I left home when I was 20. So very little exposure.
Mm-hmm. So I think that's an interesting concept because a lot of people, there's what you just said, and then there are the people that started when they were in sixth grade. So you know, it's like a two main things that I see as a recurring theme on my show. So, okay, so we're going to go with you have turned 20, and was it when you were in college that you started your drinking experience, or did you do much drinking?
Well, as I said, I had a couple experiences before I started college, but not very much. When I started college, I was a weekend drinker, very much under control. We were in Wisconsin. Wisconsin's a big drinking state, so we kind of like to party on the weekends. But, you know, the week was to do schoolwork and go to school. So there was nothing really. When I was in Japan later, I had some difficulties. I had an unhappy love affair and started drowning my sorrows. And that's when I started drinking heavily. It was in reaction to some things that happened in real life.
Mm-hmm. So you were experienced in drinking. I'm trying to get to, you know, where you're doing what you do now, that it's from, a lot of it is from experience, not from reading about it or being in a family of that. So it's coming from your drinking experience. Is that correct?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Okay, so we have the lay of the land there. So I guess we might as well ask how your drinking progressed and de-escalated, however, how did that go in your, you know, growing up?
Well, as I said, it was in reaction to some rather unhappy events that I started drinking heavily in Japan and continued after I returned to the U.S. for a while. I was pursuing my master's degree in linguistics, and I decided that, I wasn't getting my thesis finished. So I got involved with moderation management.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to do this whole sequence is a lot of stuff. But, okay, I had been through a treatment. I had checked myself into a treatment program, and it was a kind of non-standard treatment. It had a lot of cognitive behavioral stuff in it, and it had some helpful things and helped reduce my depression that I had been suffering from, which was really what was driving the alcohol use. And then I decided I needed to work on my master's thesis and, you know, actually finish my degree in linguistics. So I decided to do a pretty severe cutback and drink only one day out of the week and have 6 days of abstinence. And I would drink to intoxication on Saturday night, and that would be it for the week. And I would spend the rest of the week, you know, doing my schoolwork. Mm-hmm. And I was going to moderation management groups at this time. It was interesting because the person leading the moderation management groups in Minneapolis at the time that I was going to them was Audrey Kishline, the founder, who later became somewhat notorious.
So the moderation management that you're speaking about is in relationship to drinking.
Yes, it's a support group. It's still in existence. But moderation management is aimed primarily at early stage problem drinkers. I was kind of arguing with Audrey at the time because she said, you know, what you're doing, that's not moderation at all. And I said, yeah, but it's a lot better than when I was drinking 5 days out of the week and not getting anything done.
And right.
As you can see, even at that time, I was taking what would be considered more of a harm reduction approach and less of the moderation management type approach, although there's nothing wrong with the moderation management approach. It fits a lot of people.
Well, you know what? I have to say that we have to slow down a little because I think that we're going to be very quickly confusing my audience. I think what we need to do before we go ahead is give us your definition, your own feeling definition of moderation management, and then we will get into what harm reduction is in your perception of and what it really is.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because we're talking about both of them and haven't defined either one.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Okay.
We can start with moderation management, and I can define what it says in their book and their website. It's very clear. Moderate drinking, according to moderation management, is no more than 4 standard drinks per day for a man and no more than 14 standard drinks per day for a man per week. For a man, sorry, 4 per day and 14 per week for men. For women, it's 3 per day and 9 per week. And this is the maximum amount that's allowed under moderation management's definition of moderate drinking.
So that's a real structure there. I mean, they know they're there to the drink.
It's
not very flexible.
It's very specific and it's about standard drinks, which doesn't mean the drinks that you get in a bar, because if you order a drink in a bar, it might have 5 drinks in it. It might have 6, 7, 8. A standard drink is 1 12-ounce beer at 5%, or a 5-ounce glass of wine at 12%, or a 1.5-ounce shot of hard liquor at 40% 80-proof alcohol.
Uh-huh. So what you're saying to me, it sounds kind of like dieting. It's one of these count every single calorie kind of diet, in the same concept.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not something that somebody that likes to be general and flexible can actually be part of.
Well, as I said, a lot of people, it's particularly aimed at early stage problem drinkers, and there's a good segment of the population that fits this model well. They like these standards. It works for them. There's a whole nother segment that they're not comfortable with this kind of approach at all. And so that's where harm reduction comes in. Harm reduction is a very different approach from moderation management.
Hold on 1 second. I just want to say one thing before I forget. Those limits that you put out there, they seem like a lot of drinking. A lot of drinks. I mean, I'm not much of a drinker, but it just seems like a lot of alcohol.
Well, I don't think 14 beers in a week is an awful lot.
Oh, it's not. Okay.
Or even 4 beers in a day for a man. They're almost the same as the NIAAA and the SAMHSA, Substance Abuse and Mental Health Administration limits, which are 14 per week for a man, 4 per day for a man, and 3 per day for a woman, and 7. So it's only the 7 and the 9 per week for a woman. That's the only difference between moderation management's definition and the ones put out by the U.S. government.
So let me ask this question. It might seem like really, really basic question, but since we're on the subject of, you know, counting drinks, you said SAMHSA and these people, you know, have about the same guidelines.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what does that make? I mean, I know every person is bigger or smaller or, you know, weight, you know, and everything, you know, and deals with alcohol differently. But what is that supposed to mean that they're able to drive?
No, it has nothing to do with driving. Okay. It has to do with overall health.
Okay.
Of course,
also it's related to health, not intoxication.
Mm-hmm. People who exceed these limits are considered heavy drinkers or binge drinkers by the U.S. government.
I see. See, okay, good. That's a good clarification. Okay, so now let's talk. give us the definition of harm reduction in general, not just related to drinking.
Harm reduction is a public health strategy that encourages any positive change. And a lot of the harm reduction movement in the United States started in the 1980s. It came out of the AIDS crisis. And people realized that distributing clean needles and condoms could help reduce the spread of AIDS. And you know, the academics, the people in the ivory towers, the people in hospitals, clinics, treatment centers, none of these people were thinking about that at all. They were just, how are we going to stop people from using drugs, or how are we going to stop people from having sex? And, you know, and a whole bunch of really grassroots people said, you know, you're not going to stop people from using drugs or having sex. You've got to do something practical. So it came really out of the grassroots rather than from a university or academics. Its origin came from the grassroots. It just said, you know, my friends are dying. My friends that are shooting dope are dying because they're not getting clean needles, and we're going to start giving everybody clean needles, and we don't care that it's against the law. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there was a big movement to pass out clean needles, to give sex workers condoms, to teach them about condom use and, you know, safe sex practices and ways to prevent HIV transmission. So, and have you heard of ACT UP?
I have not.
ACT UP was a group that was very active at this time period, and they were just kind of really ignoring the laws quite often and just distributing the condoms, safe sex information right out of the trunks of their cars and, you know, clean needles. Mm-hmm. And also getting into the gay community quite a bit because there was a lot of transmission there and, you know, teaching people about safe sex. And this was the origins of the harm reduction movement.
Uh-huh. Well, I know that I read in your book that you had mentioned some other harm reduction moves in the United States that were not even related to, you know, you talked about seatbelts, for instance.
Mm-hmm. Seatbelts are harm reduction, but, you know, lots of people don't think about them that way. Lots of things, you know, putting salt down on your steps when there's ice out, when it's frozen and the steps are slippery, you know, so people don't fall and break their neck. That's a harm reduction approach to the ice that forms in the winter, just like seatbelts are for your car. And all of these strategies, you know, when we apply them to anything except drug use or sex workers, they're just common sense.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as we say, okay, we need to give drug users clean needles or give them a safe injection room, which they have in Canada, or give them heroin maintenance. You know, if they can't stop using heroin, just give them a prescription, which they do in Switzerland. And these things are very successful in reducing crime. They reduce the harms associated with drug use. They reduce disease transmission, HIV transmission, Hep C transmission. They're very effective, but the United States, a lot of people in the United States don't like that, and they just want to say, you people are bad, stop doing what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. That's, yes. Not reality, really.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we have that definition, and I also in your book, I noticed that you had quoted Salvador Dali, but we won't go to that quote, but Plato and Socrates, and I liked the quote from Plato that said, never discourage anyone who continues to make progress, no matter how slow, and it seems to me that's the concept of this program. Is that true?
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, my own experiences, I was through standard treatments twice. The first one was a little non-standard. The second was very standard. And the second in particular, you know, you're either abstinent and you're perfect or you're no good. Mm-hmm. And if you make an improvement and you say, well, I cut my drinking in half, it's like you're in denial and people start screaming in your face. And, you know, that's not helpful to mm-hmm. get, you know, especially if the change the person really wants to make is to cut back, telling them that they're bad for not being abstinent is not the way to encourage people to change for the better.
Okay. Well, I have a couple questions as a loved one of alcoholics, and then we're going to get into your program specifics because it's a little complicated, but I think that we can get it a little more basic so we can understand it just for the interview anyway.
Mm-hmm.
One of my questions is, I was reading through your book, and often when I read through books that have plans and things, the statement pops in my mind, well, that's easy for you to say. And here's one of those. You say, it's important to stay safe. So don't get in the car with somebody who's been drinking. Take the keys away and don't give them back until they're sober or not, you know, they have no more alcohol tendencies. And my thing is, that's easy for you to say. I mean, there's so many families and family members, and especially wives and mothers, who it's frightening. You know, we'd like to take that stand, and it makes sense, and it's practical. But, you know, there's a lot of anger and punishment that comes from that. And that's why a lot of people don't do that. You have any suggestions other than just do it?
Well, we have a chapter in our book about spouses, which is the chapter you're referring to. But I also want to mention another book that's out there by Robert Myers. It's called Get Your Loved One Sober, which I borrowed a lot of strategies from his ideas. I hadn't actually read his book yet when I wrote this, but I read it later, and it's a very excellent guidebook to dealing with a loved one that has a drug or alcohol problem. What's popular in the U.S. today is to do an intervention, but that's not the most successful approach. The Bob Myers approach is called CRAFT. It's Community Reinforcement and Family Training, and it's based on motivational interviewing. The success rates have been tested, and they're about twice as successful as the intervention. And one of the big problems with interventions, you know, a lot of people that get intervened on, they're so upset by it, they will never speak to their family members again afterwards, even if mm-hmm. they stop their drinking and drug use. It's a very, you know, they like it on television shows because it's very dramatic.
Yes, dramatic, a lot of drama.
But it's also a lot of trauma.
Mm-hmm.
Which is really not good. The CRAFT approach is based on motivational interviewing, and it's much gentler. And a typical CRAFT approach would be talking to someone that drinks a lot and has problems. And you start with, well, what is it you like about drinking alcohol?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people will be happy to talk about things that they like about drinking alcohol. And then you can say, well, are there any things you don't like about drinking alcohol? Of course, if they are having problems, they will not have difficulty listing things. You know, denial is not an aspect of substance use. Denial really comes from confrontation.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, confrontational counselors, I really think, are very incompetent counselors, and they just create denial by the way they attack people. And if you don't use that attacking status and you use a motivational interviewing status instead and say, well, what do you like about drinking? What don't you like about drinking? Oh, you don't like you got that DUI. Well, what do you think you might want to do about that to change things? And pretty soon people are coming up with plans on their own and saying, well, I don't want to get a DUI again. You know, drinking and driving is really bad. Here, I want to always give you, my spouse, my keys before I start drinking so that I won't be tempted to drink and drive. You know, when people come up with these plans on their own, they're much more likely to stick with them.
I'm going to play the devil's advocate here. And, you know, it all makes sense. And we actually did a show on CRAFT. So I would like to remind my audience to go to the archives page if they're interested in reading more about Robert Myers and his plan, because we did a show on that just recently, over the summer. What I'd like to say is, I had an addict in my family, and I've had alcoholics that I've dealt with, and it just seems too not realistic. It seems, yes, it would be wonderful if that worked, but to me, I mean, I couldn't imagine doing that, saying that to the people I know who are alcoholics and addicts, and having them actually go along with it. Of course, they know that, you know, what should they do not to get a DUI. But, you know, it seems too easy, you know. And dealing with addicts and alcoholics, in my experience, is not that easy. I feel like they would laugh at me if I talked to them like that.
Well, you can't always make everyone change. Mm-hmm. And one thing that is quite common co-occurring disorder with substance abuse is antisocial personality disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have a substance abuser with antisocial personality disorder, your chances of getting them to change are really low because they are the people that will, you know, they will tell you any lie that they want to and then do what they want to do.
Mm-hmm.
But that, the majority of substance users don't have antisocial personality disorder. They do like to stick to their word. I mean, I know when I was a big drinker, I was always a very honest person. One of the things they wanted me to do in treatment was tell how I was a pathological liar. And I said, this is not true at all. My problem is that I have no tact. I tell people the truth too much.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a pathological truth teller, not a pathological liar. And that's, no, that's not an acceptable answer. You have to be mm-hmm. a pathological liar if you're going to be in treatment. And I was like, this is not helping me at all. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. I don't want to get off the track.
Okay. So the other question, the other thing, as a loved one of an addict and an alcoholic, I understand that most of the people in my position, let's say they have a loved one who's an alcoholic. I don't believe for me, and I don't believe it is for the majority of the people, that the goal is to get your loved one to stop drinking. The goal really to me was more to have no more disruption and create no more drama and chaos and fear and, you know, of people driving when they're drunk and anger and violence. So, you know, I was thinking about this when I was reading through your program, and I think that it's true that it's not that we want people to just stop drinking. You know, if you can meet these goals without stopping drinking, I think that would be fine for other people. And is that your understanding in your program?
Yeah, when we're talking about the spouse of someone who has an addiction, the spouse needs to put their safety first. So they need to reduce the harms that impinge upon them from their loved one's drug or alcohol use.
Mm-hmm.
So that should always be their first goal, is, you know, to keep themselves safe and keep, you know, say the children safe. Say the typical example is the husband is the drinker and the wife is the non-drinker, and, you know, the wife, her first goal has to be to keep herself and her children safe. And, you know, Bob Myers talks a lot about this and strategies for doing it. Sometimes you just have to, you know, walk out and, you know, go to your mother's house with the kids sometimes for the night or whatever, you know, your possibility is. Sometimes you just have to leave if the person that's using the substance is totally out of control.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. So let's get to your specific overall program. And is it called HAMS?
Yes, it is called HAMS.
And why is it called HAMS?
HAMS is an acronym. The H stands for harm reduction. The
mm-hmm.
A is for abstinence from alcohol or drugs. The M is for moderation. And the S is for support. So it's a support group for any positive change in your drinking habits, from safer drinking to reduced drinking to quitting altogether.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And now I would like to do a contrast of the harm reduction approach with moderation management, which we described before. Moderation management has some set limits that we talked about, which a lot of people find them very useful, but not everybody does. But, for example, if we have someone that drinks a fifth of whiskey 4 nights out of the week, gets totally intoxicated, likes to get in their car and drive while they're drinking, and if they decide, wait a minute, drinking and driving is a really bad idea, I still want to drink the same amount, but I want to stop the drinking and driving. A harm reduction program, the HAMS program, is like the only program they can come to and say, I want to stop drinking and driving, but I still want to drink the same amount. And we will say, that's a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
This is a big improvement because you won't mm-hmm. be putting yourself at risk. You won't be putting others at risk. So this is a harm reduction approach. We are encouraging them to be safer, even though right now they're not ready to change their amounts at all. They want to drink in a manner that's safer and doesn't endanger themselves or others so much. So that's good.
And actually, I'm thinking as you're talking how it relates to the family. And just, I remember taking my car away from my son because it made much less stress for me because he wasn't out there driving the car, you know, hurting himself or killing anyone else. And this would take a big, not all of the stress, and it wouldn't solve everything for the family, but it would be a start, you know, as it would be a start for the alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
I understand that concept.
What we also see, if we encourage people to make that first positive step, then very often, you know, a short time later, a few months later, they'll come around and say, you know, I think maybe drinking, getting intoxicated, totally falling down drunk four nights a week is not reasonable. I don't want to do this anymore. I'm going to stop drinking on the work nights and just, you know, get loaded on the weekends.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, of course, we say, that's a really good idea. And we keep giving them support for every small positive change that they want to make. And all these small changes add up. And pretty soon people, you know, they either reach a non-problematic drinking level or some of them stop completely. But if you encourage people to keep making small positive changes that they choose for themselves, you can really get to a big change down the line.
Okay, I'm going to ask about the process in a minute, but I have one other question that's not in the list of process questions. Why do you think people overdrink? Are there a million reasons?
There are several reasons. There are a number of reasons. Most often, we find a maladaptive coping strategy. That's what we call it. It's very common. People are suffering depression, anxiety, social phobia, something on that order, and they start medicating it with alcohol, and at mm-hmm. first it works quite well. You know, you're depressed, you get drunk, you escaped your depression temporarily, or it calms your anxiety, it reduces your social phobia. At first, it works quite well, and then people start drinking more and more frequently, and suddenly it starts having its own negative impacts. So it turns from being a coping strategy that works well into one that's maladaptive and starts causing more problems than it's solving.
And I remember reading in your book about sleeping, that people sometimes drink so they can sleep because they have trouble sleeping. And I know a lot of people that do this, and, you know, in my own experience, just having a glass of wine sometimes keeps me awake. I mean, maybe you get to sleep, but then a couple hours later, you're up and you can't go back to sleep. I mean, is that what happens when, or is that just me?
That happens to a lot of people. You know, a small amount of alcohol will put you out, but then it goes out of your system, it gets metabolized, and then you wake up. So people start drinking large amounts. They drink two bottles of wine to go to sleep. And then they stay passed out real good, but then they're really hungover when they wake up. So it doesn't really work well. It's not a good sleep aid.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, so how does this all work? Let's say you have a – let's take a little scenario. Let's say there's a 60-year-old woman who's been drinking since high school, and she's finally decided – you know, it has made it's very difficult for her life to be drinking still, and it's bad for her, it's bad for her family, bad for her work and everything. So what would be her first step to, if she decided that she wasn't going to go to the regular, you know, let's say she's someone who is not taken by the 12 steps or the AA model and wants to do something else, what would be her first step?
Well, if she comes to our program has 17 elements, and we call them elements and not steps because they can be done in any order and none of them are required. You can pick and choose the ones you like to do. Mm-hmm. So the first thing this person would do would be either to go to our website or get a copy of our book and look through the 17 elements listed there and see which one appeals to them as a starting point.
Let me interrupt you before you go on. While we're right there, this is a good time to just put out your website and book one for the first time, so, you know, because you're talking about it.
Yes, the website is hamsnetwork.org, and the 17 elements can be found hamsnetwork.org/17. And the book is called How to Change Your Drinking, A Harm Reduction Guide to Alcohol. You can find it on Amazon. And it's on our website, hamsnetwork.org/book.
And that's HAMS.
That's correct.
Okay. Okay, so anyway, so they go on the website and look through the elements, and then what do they do?
Well, they pick one that they want to start with. If they can't decide which one to start with, we say start with number one. It's kind of in a default order, but you don't have to start with number one if one of the others appeals to you more. Mm-hmm. But number one is to do a cost-benefit analysis of your drinking. And this is also known as a decisional balance sheet. This is a tool that's been investigated quite a bit in the psychological literature for behavior change. You get out four sheets of paper. One, you write the pros of your drinking as it is right now. And the other, you write the cons of your drinking as it is right now. On the third, you write the pros of the change you want to make. Say you want to quit, so write down the pros of quitting drinking entirely. And on the fourth, you write down the cons of quitting drinking entirely.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really important to write down both the positives and the negatives. And this has been tested because, a lot of standard treatments say, make a list of all the things why drugs or alcohol are really, really bad. And all the good things, just remain in your subconscious and they never get processed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one reason why people relapse so much when they've only had this kind of standard treatment. Or I should say this kind of old-fashioned treatment. A lot of programs are moving beyond this now because they're starting to incorporate more evidence-based practices. But just making a list of why it's bad is not going to help you change very much. You have to actually recognize what's positive about drinking. First of all, it makes you aware of it. So, yes, I drink to relax. I drink because I have anxiety. It calms me down. And then not only are you aware of it so it doesn't sneak up on you when you're least expecting it, but you can also start making alternative plans. Okay, how can I relax without alcohol? How can I deal with my anxiety without alcohol? Am I going to learn to do meditation? Am I going to take up yoga? Am I going to go to the gym and exercise? What are my alternative strategies? So you're aware both of the benefits of alcohol and of alternative ways to deal with these. So that's one reason why this decisional balance sheet, this cost-benefit analysis, is a very effective tool in behavior change.
Do you think, if you've worked with alcoholics before, which I'm sure you have worked with many, that this is something that people easily can do on their own, or that they need guidance with this? Other than the book.
No, people don't need guidance to do the balance sheet. But most people do it several times, and they find that it changes when they redo it. At first, you might have a DUI, and that's your one negative about your drinking is your DUI. And you can't think of anything else negative right now. But you really don't like that because it's costing you a fortune in lawyer's fees and all this other crap, and your license is suspended and all this stuff. So that's really bad. So you can put that down for your really bad thing. And then you put down your good things, and you put down your good things about your change you want to make and the bad things about the change you want to make. And then you come back and do the same thing a couple months later, and you see, oh, wait a minute, there's another thing I didn't like about alcohol. That's those hangovers I was getting.
Mm-hmm.
And these change as you go along. But, it's not something you need a professional to help you do.
Mm-hmm.
Although some people can really benefit from a good harm reduction therapist while they're making their changes.
Mm-hmm.
It's not necessary for everyone, and it's certainly not necessary to initiate making a change. But if you feel a need for a good therapist to work with, there are some really good harm reduction therapists out there that can work with this method.
Well, that was another question I had. Are there if people really feel that they need to be have their hands held through getting to whatever point their goal is, are there rehabs or anything out there that are based on the premise of HAMS?
Well, they're based on the premise of harm reduction,
mm-hmm.
So they're compatible with HAMS.
Mm-hmm.
One is the Harm Reduction Therapy Center in San Francisco and Oakland is mm-hmm. very good, and Pat Denning is one of the Pat Denning and Jeannie Little are the founders of that program, and they have quite a few staff working there. It's an outpatient basis. It has drop-in groups. And Pat's a good friend of mine, and she was very influential. Her book, Over the Influence, was very influential on me in writing this book, as is her new book, which is Practicing Harm Reduction Psychotherapy, Second Edition. This is a really great book for professionals. Over the Influence is a really good harm reduction handbook for drug users. It also talks about alcohol a little bit, but not so much. So that's one reason I wrote my book, was to really get specific on alcohol.
And okay, so one thing I'm trying to get at is most of the population who feels that they need some help, direction, whatever, or, you know, they want to get clean and sober, whether it's completely clean and sober, you know, with abstinence or, you know, what you're talking about, most of the people, one of the biggest roadblocks is money. So what I'm talking to you here and listening to this, and I don't see where, you know, they have to really spend a lot of money on this process. What is your thought on that?
I would agree. I think probably 2 out of 3 people that do the HAMS program do it themselves with no support group and with well, maybe with or without a therapist. I don't know about that. Mm-hmm. But if I compare the number of books that are being sold with the number of people joining support groups, I see about 2 out of 3 are buying the book and not joining a support group. Mm-hmm. But we're really set up so that's perfectly all right. And we have a lot of evidence that people can overcome addictions on their own. Mm-hmm. Now, the NESARC, the National Epidemiological Survey of Alcohol-Related Conditions. They finished gathering the data in 2000, and they published some of their conclusions in 2009. It's in an article called Alcoholism Isn't What It Used to Be. This is on the World Wide Web. It's from the U.S. government, and everybody can Google this article and look up Alcoholism Isn't What It Used to Be.
Okay.
And they will find some really surprising facts. 3/4 of people with alcohol dependence overcome it. They recover.
Mm-hmm.
3/4 recover. So only 1/4 either stay the same or progress. And mm-hmm. this,
does it list how they recover? Like, did they need treatment or whatever, or did they not get into that?
Yes, this is the other thing. It's really interesting. Now, I want to also stress that this is over a 20-year period now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, but when they look at people over a period of 20 years, 3/4 recover, and of those that recover, 3/4 of those recover on their own with no treatment, no AA, no support group at all.
Uh-huh.
So actually, over half of all people with alcohol dependence recover on their own. And less than 1/5 actually recover via AA or a treatment program.
Right.
So we do know that the most common outcome of alcohol dependence is natural recovery, spontaneous remission.
Okay. So for with the people who are dealing with this in their families now, because that was over a 20-year period, and, you know, everything is immediate gratification these days. So not it's also with the families. They want immediate gratification. And this show is to help give ideas and resources, and so for all these people that can't afford to, you know, spend all this money on rehabs and things, and just feel that there's nothing to do, there are things to do, correct?
There are many things to do. The whole basis of harm reduction is to actually help spontaneous remission go faster and have less negative consequences on the way, and to actually increase the odds of having this natural recovery, this spontaneous remission. So very often the more traumatized people are, the more difficulties they go through, the harder time they have giving up drugs and alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
So the more resources people have intact, you know, the better off they are, the more quickly that they can overcome their drug or alcohol problems. This is one reason why clean needles are very important. You know, a lot of times people, they contract HIV, they get AIDS, they say, you know, it doesn't matter anymore. I might as well shoot heroin because I'm going to die. I have AIDS. Mm-hmm. So if you can keep people healthy, you give them a much better incentive to get over their drug problem because, you know, they'll have more reasons. So we really want to reduce the harms and not to traumatize people. I mean, one of the really old-fashioned rehab things they used to say is, well, if you're not ready to recover yet, you need to go out and drink more until you hit bottom and come crawling back on your knees. Well, that killed a lot of people. It's not a helpful way to do things at all. You should really try to reduce the harms, keep as many resources intact, and help people move on to a recovery as quickly as possible. One more thing from the article, Alcoholism Isn't What It Used to Be, that was really an interesting result, is that for the people that recovered, half recovered by quitting, and the other half recovered by cutting back to where alcohol was no longer a problem. They were no longer alcohol dependent, but they were still drinking. Mm-hmm. So this form of harm reduction-based recovery or moderate drinking recovery, whatever you want to call it, it's very common. It's as common as quitting is.
Do you think that it would be the same thing for drugs?
We've seen really similar results with drug users, mm-hmm. too. You know, we don't have nearly as good information because it's much harder to study because alcohol is legal, so it's easier to study.
I know people aren't as quiet about it.
We saw some really interesting results, though, at the end of the Vietnam War. We had a very large number of veterans return to the United States that were heroin addicted, mm-hmm. and 7 out of 8 of the heroin addicted veterans quit when they recovered, when they returned to the U.S., mm-hmm. because they were no longer under the horrible, stressful conditions of Vietnam. They didn't need the heroin anymore.
Right.
And even though they went through physical withdrawal, it was unpleasant, but they really didn't want to shoot the drug anymore because they didn't need it. Mm-hmm. And we did see quite a number of these people that returned. I mean, the vast majority just quit. Some of them did return to recreational heroin use now and then, some chipping without becoming re-addicted. And then I think 1 in 8 did become re-addicted. Mm-hmm. Or
but generally what you're saying, what that seems to say to me is that it's true what they say, that if you can find the underlying reason why people do these things and help change that situation and have them help, you know, change the situation for them, that is the best way to, you know, get more either sober or controlled.
Yeah, very often there are underlying situations that do need to be resolved. So some people do find it really useful to go to a therapist, especially a harm reduction therapist that understands what it's all about. As I was mentioning, there's Pat Denny in San Francisco. Also in New York City, there are several. Andrew Tatarsky is a good friend of mine. He's got a book out called Harm Reduction Psychotherapy, which he's also been pioneering this stuff for the last 20 years or so. So there's a lot of really good stuff out there.
Okay, so we're really running out of time, and I want you to give us your website again, the name of your book, and if there's anything else you think in the last moment or so that you think we should hear.
Well, the website is hamsnetwork.org. The book is called How to Change Your Drinking, A Harm Reduction Guide to Alcohol, and it's on Amazon. And what I would like to leave you with is going back to that quote from Plato, you know, always encourage every positive change, no matter how small.
Okay. Okay, excellent. I appreciate your time you taking the time to share this with us. And I'll encourage everyone to check on my radio show page. There will be live links to the website and to the Amazon page. So thank you.
Thank you.
So that was a quick education on harm reduction. I hope you'll think about it and share it with people that might be interested in knowing a little bit about that. So I want to encourage everyone to do something good for yourselves this week. Remember to take some deeper breaths every once in a while, get that oxygen moving through your system, and come back next week for some more information, possibilities, and hope.
Denise is committed to helping others facing addiction in themselves and the people close to them. In every show, she gives resources, websites, and names of people who can help. You can find many of these on her website. Just click the globe on the webtalkradio.net page in front of you. And for her book, Sweat, A Practical Plan for Keeping Your Heart Intact While Loving an Addict, please click the book cover. Thank you for listening to the show today, and please join us again next week.